Welcome to this week's edition of The Boundless Show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. I have with me the Boundless team, Candace, Steve, Mott, and Ted.
Yo.
Here in the studio.
Hello.
Give a shout out. Woo!
Nope.
Shout out.
All right. We are, this is our last week in the studio for a whole week, because yes. Next week, Mott and I are actually going to be at New Attitude in Louisville.
You're not going, Ted?
Louisville.
I'm not going this year. I've gone many years. I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years I've gone.
You're kind of like a patriarch of the...
I am a patriarch. I was in the band. I was in the New Attitude band.
Ted put the attitude in New Attitude.
Did you have groupies? Did you have groupies when you were in the band?
Don't know.
Okay, the picture
Maybe
of the
they'll
band.
Start coming forward.
You notice they have Josh Harris's wife all...
Front and
nice,
center.
Chris, uh-huh. Front and center.
In focus.
And Ted is out of focus.
I'm in the back. Actually,
so what does that tell you about his groupies?
Yeah.
Okay, what Steve's referring to is a little EP that Joshua Harris asked us to record that was produced by Quinlan, the guy who did Rebecca St. James' stuff. It was a really cool little album.
That's
you can
good.
Find it on eBay, I think, nowadays, for like $2. In any case, the
or
photo
we'll sell
shoot,
you our copy for $20.
The photo shoot had Joshua Harris's wife, Shannon, in the front on the couch, and I was sitting next to her, and the photographer said, Ted, could you move to the back, and Aaron, could you come up and sit on the couch?
Nice.
Because Aaron is a pretty boy. So I was in the back, out of focus.
Which with, made your hair Mike a little and... less obvious.
Dave Crowderish. Yeah.
Yeah, there he goes. Anyway.
Oh, that's well. That's cool. Well, if anyone comes up and tells us to say hi, we will.
Yeah. Well, the past couple of years, Ted did have people come up and say, "Oh, Ted."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love
well, they
you.
Totally will this year. They'll be like, "Where's Ted? He's so awesome." And then we'll just have to. It's like when I go to the NRB and I just have to take a bunch of books that people have written, like that the Lord laid on their heart to give to Dr. Dobson, and I have to saddle them all back, you know, because they're just about whatever their own personal.
So, what is New Attitude? That's the you're going to
what
the
is
New
it?
Attitude
I've never
conference
been there.
This
Hello,
weekend.
Tell me.
You tell us, Ted.
It's a gathering of what? 2,000, 4,000 young adults.
3,000 plus.
3,000 plus young adults.
Young adults.
It was a. It's a conference that was founded by Joshua Harris in 98, 99.
You have the T-shirts.
I do. I do.
All of them.
Right around the time Boundless was founded.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
I wonder if they're connected.
Basically, it's just a time for encouragement for young adults and. You know, across the spectrum.
And decent music, right?
And great music.
I mean, it's preaching, though, right? It's not just encouragement.
It's strong, biblical, heavy preaching.
Hardcore.
Well, and that's what I'm
high
excited about, because I don't like, I have prejudices against the South, and I think that...
watch out!
Let's just
no.
defend another group.
The South rises
against the South.
It's my time. But see, I was asking yesterday, is Kentucky part of the South? Because I only know Kentucky Fried Chicken. I don't know anything about the...
Have you ever heard of the
and
Mason
then there were
Dixon
horses?
Line?
No, I don't know what that is. So... you keep bringing it up like it's important. But I'm excited because, like, the people that are going to be there are, like, John Piper, who's not from the South, Al Mohler.
Oh, that's a Minnesota thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. Mark Dever and Josh Harris. You know, whatever. Mm-hmm. So they're people that...
Mark Dever's
John Piper,
from the South.
Okay, well, whatever.
There you go.
But he's not now. He's in D.C. But John Piper used to be my pastor.
Yeah, it's below the Mason-Dixon
Bethlehem
line.
Baptist represent. So.
So, Lisa, what you're saying is next week's podcast... will be recorded on site in Louisville.
It will. And we're actually...
That's pretty cool.
We are now so high profile, the show, that we have gotten most of the guests, most of the speakers as guests. So they will be on this show for real.
Like, and you're hoping for some interviews. For
like, Mott, are you even prepared too, to deal right? with that? Mott's going to be all deer in the headlights, like starry-eyed. So,
but we want to get some attendees to drop by the booth and...
Definitely.
Give Excellent. Us a shout out that we can
Hello,
run on
Hello, we want to meet
recording.
You.
Yeah. Yeah, we have things to give you.
Yeah.
Freebies.
So if you're listening,
yeah. if you
and
are
you come
one
by
of
the
our
booth,
four listeners, please stop yeah. by the booth.
Stop by the booth and we'll have something for you.
Do we still have those chocolate bars that we were giving away last
no,
year?
No, no. <that's>
okay.
If you're listening and you're going to New Attitude, drop by the booth and we will give you something. We don't know what it is.
We're still shopping.
It's awesome.
Free food.
It may be, it'll probably be that EP that Ted was a part of that maybe we have boxes right. of somewhere. All right, speaking of music, I want to give a shout out to Keith Cooper from Dallas, who is providing the music for us today. Again, because the show is so high profile, I know him personally. I met him at the NRB, and his wife is a good friend of mine. Yeah. He is a fantastic guitarist.
He is.
I don't even know the appropriate verbiage for it. I mean, I would say he could do classical guitar, but he definitely does. He shreds.
Just say new
he
age.
Does all kinds of virtuoso.
It's mood.
It's
mood
not
guitar.
New age.
Chill.
Whatever.
Chill.
He does this awesome thing of all the Nutcracker music, like put in one medley. Oh. And it's really, you can totally YouTube him. Keith Cooper, yo. Okay, so find him. The music today is provided by him, and we'll probably have extended sections of that. So take a listen. Today's roundtable, the idea actually came to us from a message that we got from one of our listeners, and pretty pertinent. She's basically talking about getting over a relationship, and who amongst us hasn't had to do that? She basically is saying that she had this boyfriend for 4 years, and they broke up last December. And basically, she's experiencing it as a terrible loss. And I think she says here, she feels it's probably for the best, but the knowledge of that doesn't reduce the intensity of the pain. And she talks about feeling an actual bereavement, and she felt that she did love him, and she still loves him. And so how in the world is she going to get over him? And so I think this brings up the concept of what some of us were talking about relationships that kind of turn into things that are so deep and so attached and so intimate on many different levels, that when they do end, as many of them can, it ends up almost feeling like a divorce. And I think there are lots of levels in which that plays out. So I'm going to throw that out to the table here, and who wants to jump in and start talking about the situation?
Well, 4 years, you know, yeah, that's a long time. I can understand why she feels heartbroken and feels like she just went through a divorce. 4 years is just too long, and it's just 4 years of intimacy and going deeper and deeper and deeper and developing an emotional intimacy. I'm wondering if they went too far physically. It's just too long.
Well, and you have to wonder what happened after 4 years. Did they finally discover something that they didn't know earlier?
At 3 years.
Yeah, because, you know, for instance, we have the Define the Relationship Assessment on the Boundless website. And one of the things we look at is to see, what's the level of connection in terms of how much time they spend together, how physical their relationship is, what they call it, versus the clarity about where they're going, where their future is going, how much they know about this other person and whether or not they would be a good spouse. And what we're seeing is so many people who go overboard on the connection side and still don't really know who these people are. So that's where I think some of these very painful divorce-like breakups can come from, is people who had a lot of connection but didn't have a lot of clarity. And then all of a sudden you can have 4 years later, they realize, oh my gosh, I had no idea that such and such, something you would think they would have found out in a couple of months maybe.
Mm-hmm. So why is this happening? Like, what do you think is the problem? Like, people going into relationships, what are they doing wrong?
Having sex.
Well, the sexuality, I think, is okay. Obviously the most binding. If you think about any relationship, they're becoming one. And there's a lot of things you can do to become one, the time you spend together, becoming emotionally one in how close you feel. But obviously sex has a chemical element to it that bonds you, that makes you one. And just about every time we hear about a very painful, bitter, difficult breakup, we're not surprised to find out that there was a physical connection. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not judging this particular situation. I know you can have a very painful breakup without sex, but often sex is very much at the center of some of the most painful breakups.
I'd say that a big factor might be lack of intentionality. You've mentioned, Steve, in previous podcasts about how oftentimes two people back into a relationship. They find themselves dating. How did that happen? And then a few years later, they find themselves backing their way onto the altar. Mm-hmm. And perhaps that's what happened here. They found themselves close after 2 years. They're dating, and I don't know where it's going. Another year, I don't know. Are we getting married? I don't know.
Well, I think it's so culturally accepted to act married when you're not married. Mm-hmm. And you do things that really do link you and make those connections so intense that it's not hard to imagine 4 years going by and people... I think in another day you'd say 4 years, you've been dating 4 years. Why aren't you making any progress?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they feel like they're making progress. The women feel like the men are getting closer to marriage because they're giving more and more in terms of acting married. But I think the men don't necessarily see those concessions as moving them closer to the altar.
Well, people don't know how to practice restraint nowadays anyway. They just don't know how. I mean, like Ted said, they fall into relationships and they share everything. Even up front, even on like the second or third date or whatever. And so I think they need to be taught how to practice restraint on the front end, in the middle, and in the end too.
Well, and the danger with not practicing the restraint is that you end up in a relationship that everybody else around is seeing how maybe bad the relationship is, and yet the two involved can't seem to break up. They can't seem to disconnect, and it's because, like Steve said, they became one, and now to break up would feel like a divorce, and yet they're not making any progress forward, and it really gets stymied.
Let me spin something here. I think some of our listeners might be hearing what we're talking about. They might feel like we're condemning them if they've been in a relationship for 2 years, 3 years, whatever. I think what we're talking about is exciting and hopeful, that it's possible to date for a mere 6 months, year,
and
you have
got
a good idea. Mm-hmm. This is somebody I want to marry. I was a little older when I started dating the woman who became my wife, but we dated for 4 months, and we got engaged. Mm-hmm. What were we doing? We were friends for 4 months. We dated for 4 months. Then we were engaged for 4 months, and then we were married.
Well, and that
so
used
it can
to
happen.
Be, well, and that used to be common.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what did you find out about her in 4 months that enabled you to say, okay, I can marry her? Because I think what a lot of these people are doing, like the right. friends I have, are they go out with someone 4 or 5 times, and all of a sudden they're like BFFs with this person's family. They're talking about their family uh-huh. as though they're their own. There's a lot of just crossed, blurred lines with stuff. How did you keep
across
that separate?
Our relationship was characterized by purity. And when there was lack of impurity, we were able to discern God's will with a lot of clarity. We're also transparent with the folks around us, including at our church and with her family. We're open to input and guidance and counsel from those around us. We had good discussions about doctrine and about plans for the future. And after, 4 months, that's a good deal of time for having some good conversations. We just knew.
It's a framework issue that the impression I get from your relationship is that you didn't act like you were married, that you acted as if this is an evaluation season.
Yes.
And yes, you can enjoy each other's company.
Oh, we did.
But if you have the mindset of...
That's good.
Now, I know every analogy can break down, but if you almost act like it's an interview... No employer is going to just let a new employee drift into a relationship with the organization where they start giving them a salary and some benefits and they've never even signed a contract or anything. And I think we've rushed into wanting to enjoy relationships so much that people act married and want to rate all the benefits of marriage, even though they haven't really done that crucial evaluation phase.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and the danger, I hear it in the pain of this gal's email, is that you end up being so connected with the person that you really risk the chance that you'll never again be able to make it with anybody else. That if this one relationship, it's like you really do put all your eggs in this basket, and if this relationship doesn't happen, you may be so emotionally damaged that you'll never be open to love with anyone else and marriage with anyone else.
I love the standard that you should approach any potential relationship, any opportunity getting to know someone with the goal that if things don't work out, if you realize you're not a good fit for each other, that you can still be brothers and sisters in Christ, and that you wouldn't feel uncomfortable at all sitting down next to them in a church service with your future spouses beside you, that you wouldn't have any awkwardness, no sense of shame or embarrassment of things that you've done.
It speaks to the different stages of a relationship that Scott Croft goes into in his series on relationships. Where you begin and you very generally you want to find out if this person might be someone you want to marry, and then you take it to the next level of intimacy.
And by intimacy, you mean?
Yeah, I'm thinking that this like applies to about less than 1%, or not applies, but that about less than 1% of Christian singles are doing this. So what?
Being intentional?
Yeah, doing this, like what Steve's saying. You know, I mean, like the almost like the interview kind of thing. I mean, how do you do this without being a cultural freak? And how do women, for example? I've had like one conversation with a guy and felt connected. I mean, I think it's different.
Yeah,
why women are more difficult.
Women need. I think women are in a position to hold back, to restrain, to not... one thing that women can do right now is stop having phone calls after 10 o'clock at night that last for more than 30 minutes. I mean, I'm amazed at how normal it's become to talk on the cell phone for 4 hours in the middle of the night. That is not something that people who aren't married should be doing, really.
I've heard of 8-hour conversations, just FYI.
Well,
8 hours.
Well, but are you married to that guy?
Oh, no, I haven't had them.
Oh, okay.
Mine were no more than six. Hello.
See, where did that get you?
That's restraint.
But even, Ken,
well, I hadn't heard you say that before.
I'm not sure.
Okay, I just want to go on the record that conversations on the telephone over 30 minutes are not a good thing.
I'm not sure it's a good thing even in the beginning of a relationship, though. That might even be reserved for the next level. I mean, the beginning is mainly a discovery phase.
Right, just getting to know.
Yeah, getting to know. Right. You keep it very general. You talk about movies, and this is what Scott talks about in his articles. Movies or books, very generally about your faith. And that is sort of a prolonged observation period, and it's what you begin with. And then at that point, at some point, you decide to take it to a next level.
Well, the internet has made it so easy to divulge everything about yourself. And it feels like you're not risking much because you can't even see the person's face. It's all on email or it's all texting or it's all on Facebook or however it's being done right this minute. And I think that undermines this whole idea of being able to get to know somebody in a non-intimate way initially.
Well, and it is a dance. I think people forget the art of the dance, and that a lot of the hurt and brokenness we're talking about is someone who is handling the steps all wrong and is giving up so much of themselves instead of knowing that there is something to be said for reserving, holding something back, so that there really is a difference when you get married. Because that's why I think you've got people now who getting married for them, and we've said this before, is all this that we currently have minus, meaning minus my friendships and my options, being able to pick up and leave whenever I want to. And anybody who's in that kind of situation, you know a breakup is going to be difficult because this is someone who is already getting all the benefits, all the experience of marriage, just not the commitment, the willingness to stick around.
I think it's difficult for a lot of singles now because what they see modeled is you meet somebody, you get physically, emotionally intimate right off the bat. That's what they see in TV, movies, and there aren't very many examples of those who, for example, did it the way I did it. I think it was exciting the way that Ashley and I courted, were engaged, and got married. I think it's exciting because it was so countercultural. Mm-hmm. I remember when Ashley and I were sitting in a park, a couple of pieces of paper in front of us at the beginning of our relationship, and I said, let's just scribble down, let's just brainstorm what our relationship should look like. And, you know, who does that? But it was fun, and it was lighthearted, but it was serious. And we wrote down purity, fun, God word. We wrote down a number of adjectives, and we were able to enjoy our relationship within these boundaries. And it was great. It was lighthearted. It was fun. It wasn't like all these heavy rules and stuff. You know?
I don't want to mislead people to think that we're just saying, you shouldn't, you can't, you mustn't. This isn't about...
Right.
Don't have sex or just be abstinent. I love the talk we heard a couple of weeks ago from Christopher West, and he alluded to it a little bit on the show, but then to hear him talk about being chaste as believers, and that isn't just something you do before marriage, it's something you bring into your marriage, that we live chastely, that we, and it's not just about not having sex before marriage and finally having sex and anything else you want after marriage with this person who now owes it to you. I mean, that is just not a biblical understanding of relationship. And so I love this idea, this challenge of living as a chaste woman and as a chaste man in your relationships before you're married, because I think it creates such a healthy protection against overindulging in the intimacy, but also this over-divulging of yourself.
Well, and I think part of that is that it's chastity is a concept of being other-centered. That I suspect there are two things that happen in these intensely painful breakups. One is that someone is looking for a partner, a relationship, to give them something that was never intended to give them, that God has designed them for, to be met by Him. And that instead of looking to this relationship to be the end-all be-all, that God's asking them to reflect His love to another person, to put their needs above their own. And I think so often people go into a relationship wanting to get all those perks and benefits out of it instead of thinking what they're going to give, but also not realizing how often they might objectify the other person for their gratification. And so someone who is other-centered, it's harder for them to get as broken up about a relationship, especially if they're grounded in their relationship with God first and foremost, and see this relationship as an opportunity to give from a Christian context instead of just what they're going to get out of the relationship.
That actually reminds me of our discussion last week about idolatry as it mm-hmm. pertained to sports, for example. And what you're saying, I think, Steve, is true, that, you know, when we put a person in the place that is rightfully designed for God and for our relationship with Him, you know, trouble can ensue. And obviously, what I think that's where I see many of my friends erring, and myself probably in the past too, in just you're not only leaving the person, but you're leaving all this thought life that you built up around the person and the potential of what could have been and what, and you just build this fantasy that may or may not involve the person, that may or may not even reflect the person. And I think it's a good reminder for us all. For this week's culture segment, we have with us in the studio a laryngitis-challenged Bob Olszewski. I think that's from sitting in all the cold theaters, no doubt, watching movies. That's how one gets sick. So we're going to have him on here in a minute. But before we begin, I do want to acknowledge, many of you have probably heard that Stephen Curtis Chapman, a Christian music artist extraordinaire, lost his daughter this week. She was killed in their driveway by a car. Basically just a tragedy. And I know that the Christian music community is reaching out to that family. Stephen Curtis Chapman is a huge friend of Focus on the Family. We've had him here many times. And so we just want to collectively from the Boundless Show acknowledge that and just extend our prayers and our sympathies to Stephen Curtis Chapman and to his family and to really the music community and those who know them, because this is a huge loss. And we've dealt with loss a lot here at Focus on the Family. Dr. Bill Meyer, who's our psychologist in residence here, has often talked to stations and others beyond just about tragedies and how to cope with tragedies, how to talk to your kids about tragedy. And it's certainly something that affects us as 20 and 30 somethings as well. So Stephen Curtis Chapman, your family, the Christian music community, everyone there in Nashville, our hearts go out to you, as do our prayers. So All right, Bob Bolasheski here in the studio with us. We're going to hit on a couple things today, so we're going to move pretty quickly and accomplish this culture segment at a whirlwind pace. We want to talk about summer movie blockbusters, which seems to me, Bob, that this is kind of like the opportunity for parents to have their kids babysat by the movies during the course of the summer. But there are a lot of that have come out. We talked a little bit about Iron Man. I went and saw it, thought it was good. I decided that I like superheroes now who don't have special powers, but who maybe are just tormented billionaires. That's my new...
And are very creative when it comes to building their own suits
exactly.
that can do everything.
Well, and where did all that scrap metal come from? I mean, it was just sitting around, apparently.
You're a billionaire, they'll FedEx exit just in minutes, just overnight.
That's true, from wherever it needs to come from. But now we haven't talked yet a lot about Prince Caspian, about some of the others that are coming up too. Obviously, Indiana Jones. Just talk to us briefly, Bob, about what really people in our audience can look forward to this summer as they decide what movies they're going to go to.
Well, Prince Caspian opened with $55 million. It was a little bit of a disappointment, I think, for Disney. I would think they were hoping it would make at least as much as the first installment, The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, with $65 million. But hey, $55 million is a lot of money. And I think this may be a little bit of a slow burner. I liked this movie a lot, Lisa. I mean, a lot. Now, I say that with a qualifier, and that is pretty much for junior high or senior high, for this audience, for college, for 20-somethings, 30-somethings, on up. This is a great, great movie. It really is a little bit too intense, in my opinion, as a war movie, which is really at its core what it really is, for, say, you know, load the minivan up with the elementary age, you know, 5-year-old, 7-year-old, 9-year-old kind of movie. But take that disclaimer aside and assume that we're talking now to say, you know, a college age 20-something who's saying, I would love to go see that with a couple of my friends this weekend. Would it even be worth my time? Would it have even appeal to me? And I would say definitely. It's well acted. The special effects are just, you know, phenomenal and very, very expensive on the screen. The story is beloved by C.S. Lewis for years and years. And essentially, Caspian the Ninth has been murdered. Caspian the Tenth, or Prince Caspian, goes into exile, where he finds out that the stories of Aslan and the stories of talking animals, which he's been told aren't true anymore, really are true. So it's really a story about the return of faith and what it means to have legitimate faith. And anyway, love the message, love the film. So,
well, and I think it's cool to see that, you know, this is something not only will lots of folks in our audience identify with the story because of the books and they read them when they were younger, but it's another great movie that you can go and just recognize a lot of awesome themes, great for discussion, great for talking about, and great for taking nieces and nephews and others who, you know, like you said, are
a little older.
Yeah, a little older. So kind of makes me wonder, though, what in the world if they ever make The Last Battle? I mean, if this is if this is full of this much battle, I'm disacquainting myself with ancient, apparently ancient battle tactics or something.
I think Andrew Adamson will have to do the PG-13 rating. He squeaked by with a PG somehow on this one. I'm not exactly sure how. Uh-huh. The body count is very high, but I don't know if he could for the final book.
Well, as my dad used to say, PG means pregnant with violence. So that was his argument for keeping us out of the theaters. All right, let's talk a little bit about Indiana Jones. I am just sketched out by this because I'm like, Harrison Ford is old. I mean, we got another skull. We've always got something weird going on. What do you think about it?
It's pretty much what you've seen in the past with any of the three first installments. Expect, again, a little bit more on steroids at some degree with number 4. So any concerns that I had, a smattering of some language, not egregious, but there's some. The violence that you would expect from we've seen in earlier installments, the body count again being high, you get again. For folks, I gave it a 3 out of 5 for family mm-hmm. friendliness. I tell you the truth, though, Lisa, something that I wasn't able to say on my little 60-second feature that I do is that I found the ending very unsatisfying. Mm-hmm. I was expecting more out mm-hmm. of it. I was expecting to kind of go, feel good. And there's supposed to be a kind of a feel-good moment at the end, but it just didn't resonate with me. And it's a hold on to your seat, we're going for a ride, as all the Indiana Jones have been. Lots of action, and here we go. But by the time you've been on the ride, and you've been there for 2 hours in the theater, and then you come to the conclusion, you're going, oh, is that all there is? You know?
So. Well, so speaking of not having a feel-good feeling, I want to talk about Sex and the City, which actually is going to release. And this is your chance to, I know I heard from you on this a little bit, to unleash some of your anger against the movie industry and the writers who create this stuff. Tell us about that. Bob, I know friends who are going to go to this.
Yes.
I know friends who watch the show. I know friends who are going to go to the movie. So what are your feelings about it?
Well, I found what I consider to be an incredible ABC story that to me kind of sums it all up. It was a very, very powerful story that in the beginning of the piece, interviewed a 20-something who was, at age 14, a huge Sex and the City television show fan. Mm-hmm. And she admitted that the show helped shape her moral values, or in this case, the lack thereof. The quote is this from her. She said, "Carrie smoked, so I smoked. Samantha looked at hooking up with random people as not a big deal, so that's what I did too." Admitting that her life went down a trail that I know she regrets big time, because she took the Sex and the City as a template of acceptable behavior. And when she emulated what she saw, it only caused her heartache and problems. And to this very day, she's, you know, reaping that whirlwind of problems. So when it comes to the big screen, can we expect that this R-rated version that it's going to be toned down, as some people had originally told us? No, it's ratcheted up. So I'm big on influence. That's why I come with a passion to the microphone to talk on this podcast and other places about media, because I believe media is influential. And it breaks my heart to read this, because she represents just the tip of the iceberg. Who's actually counting the people who have similar stories, who say, how many of you can relate to doing something really stupid or immoral because you saw it on a movie or in something like Sex and the City or Sex and the City directly? I think there are a lot of people who would raise their hands if we could somehow get across a census of America. But no one's asking the question. But ABC, this article kind of gave it. It's like the cat's out of the bag. Okay, there's one, and it's not just one. There's many of us. So plenty of reason, I think, to throttle back and really try to honor the Lord with our entertainment choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is, I mean, I think that's a discussion that needs to happen among our listeners, because many will say, you know, oh, these girls are just, you know, they're just having fun. They're in their 20s, they're in their 30s, whatever. They're just out there. But you're basically saying there is nothing redemptive in this storyline whatsoever. Oh, sure. Maybe they're friends. Okay. But probably full of sex, language, whatever. Not a good model for how young adults should be living.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whether they're in Manhattan.
And because I know people get their cues from this, there's to me, and I know it's not a popular opinion, but there's just no, this is just one for sure to skip, you know?
Okay.
We don't need this kind of thing. And in a culture, it's bad for us. And personally, as believers, I don't think it's great for our inner man.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you can get more from Bob Olszewski at pluggedinonline.com. Thanks for weighing in on this, Bob, not only on the summer movies in general, but obviously on Sex and the City, since that one's coming up. Again, we'll hear more from you in the future. Thanks again for being here.
You bet, Lisa.
This week's Hungry Years, Steve Waters tells us how it's not just the clothes that make the man, sometimes it's his character.
There's an old saying, clothes make the man. And that's what bugged me about my first professional job. My clothes didn't make very much of me at all. Taking a job at the Christian college I had attended, I was required to wear a suit and a tie.
but they only gave me a jeans and t-shirt kind of salary. In fact, my pay was so low that the president of the college joked that I was working for all the pizza I could eat. While my colleagues walked around in their business best, I tried to get by on a couple of pairs of khakis, button-down Oxford shirts, a jacket my dad wore in the 60s, a pair of second-hand shoes, and a few well-worn ties, including a sock tie still stained from my days as a Kmart stock boy. Even though I tried my best to make a good impression, I felt like I was at the bottom of the clothing food chain. Around that time, I read Jerry Seinfeld's commentary on suits. He said, "The suit is definitely the universal business outfit for men. I don't know why it projects this image of power. Why is it so intimidating?" he asked. He speculated that when people saw a man in a suit, they couldn't help but think, "Wow, we'd better listen to what this guy says because his pants match his jacket." I got a good laugh out of this, but I also got myself some suits. Now, it required a big chunk of my paycheck, but I made it a priority to dress up my business clothes. Before long, I finally was looking professional. My coworkers could hardly recognize me in my new wool suit, straight collar, pinpoint shirts, silk Italian ties, and suspenders, or what the men's store informed me were properly called, braces. In a few short months, I'd gone from feeling poorly dressed to expecting a nomination any day for the most dapper employee. There was something about putting on a suit in the morning that gave me all the confidence I needed for the day. You could say it also gave me a little swagger. I noticed that in an old picture of me, 22 years old, sitting in my office, kicked back, wearing my crisp suit, and sporting a rather smug smile. Meanwhile, on the other side of campus, I had an uncle, who also worked for the college. Uncle Gary returned to finish a degree that he had started in the 60s, and to support his studies, he took on the job of managing the college's sanitation department. Well, he wasn't expected to wear a suit and tie for the sanitation department. In fact, he was expected to wear a shirt with his name sewn on it. Early on, I felt a little embarrassed when Uncle Gary would stop to talk on campus. We looked like a clash of blue-collar and white-collar culture. But I thank God for putting Uncle Gary in my life back then to balance out my unhealthy focus on image. As I observed him, I realized he had more strength in his identity than I could ever project with my suit and title. He wasn't a man who was made by his clothes. No, he was a man made by his godly character and by a humble willingness to serve. I used to get grossed out by the stories he would tell of the messes that students would leave for his team on a daily basis, stories too graphic even for this audience. But it gave me a perspective I needed. It reminded me of a question H. Jackson Brown Jr. once asked. Which would be more obvious, if you didn't do your job for 30 days or if a janitor didn't do his for 30 days? I started wondering if anyone would even notice if I didn't do my suit and tie job for 30 days or even 2 or 3 months. That challenged me to be more than an empty suit, wasting time managing my image, and instead to find the equivalent in my job of the big messes I needed to take on. More importantly, it reminded me that I was called to serve in humility, regardless of the nature of my work or the tags on my clothes.
We've been listening to the music of Keith Cooper on this show, and you can find out more about him and his music and just what he's up to by going to boundless.org, checking out the post on the blog, or just rooting around there, finding out about him. So good guy, great music. So, all right, opening up today's inbox, I have Candace with me in the studio.
Ready
to rock and roll on this one. This is going to be interesting.
The guys have left us. It's just you and me.
I know. Look at that. You, me, and Mindy. Our question today is from Mindy.
Okay.
So we're going to address this. This is very fascinating. I can't wait to see what you have to say on this. And I will begin. Mindy says that she has a friend who is an absolutely amazing guy. He's a believer who follows Christ. He's respectful, responsible, friendly, and has many other qualities that are sought after in a relationship, and we get along really well. We could sit and talk for a long time without running out of topics, and we have shared interests. We've been friends for the past 9 months, and since school ended, the friendship has started becoming a little more one-on-one since we live a couple cities away, and so many of our friends went back home. I'm not sure what his intentions are, but if he does decide to pursue a relationship with me, I'm not sure what to do. Like I said, I really enjoy spending time with him and think he's a great guy, but there is zero physical attraction and no romantic feelings. A couple people I've talked to say that romantic feelings may come later and that physical attraction isn't really needed on the girl's part. Can a relationship work if there's no physical attraction and no real spark on the girl's part?
Mindy, this is a good question. Yes, but that's my short answer.
Okay. helpful.
I think you have enough there to date him. To, you know, if he lets you know that he wants to pursue something more and be intentional about your friendship and make it, you know, this whole investigation process that Mont talked about of seeing if maybe it could lead to something else. I think you respect him. You enjoy his company. You have a lot in common, it sounds like. You said you could talk for a long time. Of course, you don't want to do that after midnight on the cell phone like we talked about earlier. But if it's in the park,
for 6 hours.
That's right. If it's in the park and you're surrounded by people, you're good. No, I think it's enough to consider, but I don't think it's enough to move forward in marriage. And Lisa, I think you may even disagree with me a little bit about this. Some of our listeners probably will. I think reading Song of Solomon and knowing that that is the centerpiece of scripture and being married myself and knowing a lot of people who are married, at some point, attraction is an important element that goes into the marital relationship. You need to love this person, not just in an agape way, but also in an eros way, and that is part of the marriage relationship. So, what do you think, Lisa?
No, I actually agree with you. I think most of my, you know, I think that so few Christian friends even get to this point where they are willing to consider the person in a dating relationship because, oh, there's just no. I always say the dreaded word is chemistry. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always everyone says there's just no chemistry,
right.
And I think that's just
the
nuts.
Fireworks aren't going off like Bobby with Millicent. The Brady Bunch.
Exactly, yeah. Well, and it's true because I was talking with a friend about this the other day, just how historically I cannot pinpoint any specific type of guy that I've ever been attracted to. It's always a different, you know, an amalgamation of components, you know,
right,
of this
as
person.
As you get to know him.
Yeah, you get to know him. And I mean, there are some people that, you know, I could say objectively, oh my goodness, how was I attracted to him? But I was. So, you know, I mean, that gives hope to everyone, yeah.
Well, I
guess. So.
I have to say, I'm thankful that Steve was willing to take a risk on our friendship and to move into the dating phase before he felt all the sparks and the bells and whistles that you assume you have to have the first time you see someone, that he took the advice of Dr. Morgan to let love grow in our friendship. And that did happen. We, as we got to know each other better and shared more and more and more about what we hoped for the future, realized that we were so aligned. And I think the attraction did come, but it's important to note, it came before the wedding. Mm-hmm. It wasn't something, you know, we said, well, we like each other, we respect each other, we're going to agree to get married and hope for the best. It wasn't that at all. By the time we were married, we were ready and excited and attracted and all the, you know, all the, mm-hmm. the sparks that you need for the Song of Solomon mm-hmm. action to happen. So
how do you combat, like, how would a woman combat some of the maybe lies that the culture is telling us? Like, we've talked about this before. If a woman is just going to write someone off because he's too short, he's too thin, he's either too a bunch of things or he's not enough. I mean, how do you get past all those stereotypes?
Well, I think you pray for grace and ask God to open your eyes to the good things he has for you. And, you know, if you're around a guy and you get that sick feeling in your stomach, you know the one I'm talking about. Okay.
You want to run.
Yeah. You've got to trust your gut. I'm not saying force it if it's not there. But if you genuinely enjoy this guy's company, but you just can't see yourself yet kissing him passionately, that's okay. Mm-hmm. Because you really shouldn't be kissing him passionately yet anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that you've got lots of time for that stuff to come. So.
Exactly. You don't have to be attracted to him to obviously interview him, as we talked about in the roundtable.
You don't have to be ready to bear his children on the first date.
Okay. Well, that's hopeful. I think that'll be helpful for Mindy. So, Mindy, we're saying, should the chance come about, maybe give it a chance.
Yeah.
And then write to us.
and let us know.
And tell us how it went so that we can, you know, so that Candace can feel good about her answer because, you know, it's good.
It's not about me. It's about you,
Mindy. No, it's a good
answer.
Other people, this will apply to you as well. So, again, that will be it for this week's edition of The Boundless Inbox. Write to us with your questions and your concerns. We want to address them in a future show. Write to us at editor@boundless.org. And always check for responses, check for updates. Follow us on the blog, people. Weigh in on all these issues. We want to hear from you. So that's it for another edition of The Boundless Show. As we're heading into the end of May, again, check us out next week. We're going to be at New Attitude, my first time there. I'm excited about it. So stop by and visit us. And next week's show will be about everything that happens there. So hopefully we'll survive. Until then, I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. Have a great week.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.